come to order. Please take the roll.
Representative Keller?
Here.
Representative Millett?
She's excused.
Representative Christ Tompkins? Representative Gaddis?
Here.
Representative Hughes?
Here.
Representative Isaacson?
Here.
Chair Lang? Here. Thank you, everybody. Today we have two bills on our docket. HB 366, it says involuntary commitment. That is what it says, but it actually is more than that, and the sponsor will explain that. Other one is HB 235, confidentiality of APOC complaints. Sponsor of that one is Representative Higgins. Sponsor first, Representative Pruitt. Representative Pruitt, will you please come forward and introduce yourself and tell us about your bill? And we have a CS on this, but I believe we're going to have you maybe talk to the CS, and then after that's over, we'll see about adopting the CS.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Lance Pruitt. I represent District 25, which is in East Anchorage. I have with me Morgan Hobson from my office, and she has been the go-to person extraordinaire on this particular bill, and so she's here to go into depth a little bit more on the bill. I want to start off with just kind of giving an indicator of what kind of led to this bill. Make sure, especially as in a state where we have a pride in ownership in guns, and of course our Second Amendment rights are very well protected here, why we would be talking about a bill that has that discusses some sort of limitation for certain people on the ability to purchase those weapons. The bill itself came from the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is basically the gun manufacturers, is kind of the short way of putting it. And when I was originally approached to consider working on this bill, I actually thought about it for a month and a half. I spent some considerable time trying to, dig through it, make sure that I understood what the intent was, make sure that I was that it would not infringe upon, of course, that inherent right to the Second Amendment and gun ownership for Alaskans. And as I talked to people outside of this building, friends, and kind of discussed what we were doing, people would say, that's a pragmatic and understandable approach to how to handle some of the issues that are current for today. What this bill will do is it will allow Alaska for the first time to communicate limited information to the federal, the NICS database, the Federal Instant Criminal Background Check System, for individuals who have been involuntarily committed for 30 days into.
Look, recognize that Reverend Christ Tompkins joined us.
Thank you, Mr.
Please continue.
Communicate that information to the NICS database. It's limited information. It's just their name, and Morgan will probably actually has some of those details. It's name. It does not go into depth of why they have been placed into the database. So there's nothing to look up and say, oh, this person was put in for X reason. And there's also very important a process to actually have the information removed as well. So I think that's of course a key thing that we worked with the NRA to make sure that was in this bill. Some of the people that are probably you'll indicate who's impacted by this. Well, one, the federal firearms, the federal, and I always, there's too many acronyms in this, the FFLs, the federally licensed firearms retailers essentially. They're some of the people that, of course, they sell these items, and for them, they've got to make sure that they're always kind of under the microscope and scrutiny. This protects them a little bit as well, because now they've got the kind of this secondary. Hey, we've got some information communicated, and it's another layer to really assist them in making sure that they're not selling guns to an individual who might not necessarily need it. Last thing that I'll touch on before maybe handing it over to Morgan is the process for the voluntary commitment. I want to make sure that you understand that in Alaska, that process is an incredibly detailed process. It is not a random thing. It's just not one individual. It's not a psychiatrist says this guy needs to be committed, just lock him away. It includes court hearings. It goes through the judicial process, and I think I want to make sure that you're comfortable with understanding that this, to get to this point, takes a lot of security. In the sense of the court system itself, making sure that the individual has met the requirements to have to be involuntarily committed. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will pass it over. If you have any questions, you're going to have to pass it over to Morgan.
Are you or is she going to talk about the changes in the committee substitute?
I can have
either one
speak to that, actually.
Yeah, because okay. Yeah, I'd like to know the changes from the original bill.
Not a problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I can speak to the changes and then go through.
Yeah, introduce yourself.
My name is Morgan Hobson, SAFTA Representative Lance Pruitt. And I can go through some of the changes in the CS or start with an overview. Whichever, please.
Why don't you do the overview, and then maybe where the changes are, you can hit it as you go through the overview.
Sure, wonderful. So HB 366 pertains specifically to the transmittal of limited information from the courts to DPS and the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, also known as NICS. This database informs the federal firearms licensees, who are the firearms retailers, whether to proceed, deny, or delay a transaction with a customer who is wishing to purchase a firearm. Alaska currently only has one person listed in the NICS database who is restricted from firearm ownership for mental health reasons. Other states, for example, Texas has 217,582 records, mental health records, in the database on their behalf.
They have 200 and we have one?
Yes. Because certain states have implemented policies for transmittal of these records. We will be joining 25 other states if we do so. As current Alaska law stands, federal firearms licensees can unknowingly sell weapons to a person who is disqualified from owning a firearm. In 2003, they made 93,405 inquiries into this system just from Alaska. So that's 127 inquiries per 1,000 residents. So it's a fairly high number. Actually, it's second only to Kentucky, according to Legislative Research's information that we included in the backup. The information transmitted is very limited to identifying information. It's indicators such as the person's name, place of birth, date of birth, social security number, and all of this is if known, and that actually was one of the changes that we made. We worked with the courts. Most of the changes in the blank CS that we've brought in today are changes that we've worked with the courts to facilitate how this process will be implemented on their behalf. And we can go into that in more detail as well. We've also outlined an appeal process, which was one of all of our first reactions when we listened to this. We thought, well, is there going to be a way that someone could reverse this if they later were found not to be suffering from a mental illness and the courts could deem them reasonably fit to own a firearm at that time. It is a very scrutinous process, and there is a lot of course, there's a lot of discretion that the judge would use in that situation. Hmm. So it would require a preponderance of the evidence, for sure, for the person to regain that license or the ability to purchase. And as Representative Pruitt said, all of these hearings are full-dress formal hearings. In some other states, these decisions can come from a department, and so there's stricter rules about how the process has to be handled. Here in Alaska, these would all be full-dress hearings in a court. Furthermore, I'll wrap up here just by saying we urge you to support the bill to ensure that NICS has comprehensive information. And maybe to outline some more of the changes, I will go to the bill drafter Kathleen Strauss-Bau, who I believe is online.
Yes, she is. I have her here.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And for your information, we have online, we have Jake, how do you pronounce it, Grigge? Anyway, he's from Director of State Affairs, Farm Industry. We have Melissa Ring, Alaska Psychiatric Institute for Questions, Kathy Monfredo, DPS, Statewide Services. We have Sherry Baker from NIC, Kathleen Fosberg, as we just said, Ledge Legal, Randall Burns, Division of Behavioral Health in Anchorage, and we have in our audience Nancy Mead, who's no stranger to this committee. Okay, any questions so far? And then I want to see about adopting the CS, but let's get your question. But you were first, and then the
Representative
Hughes.
So either Representative Pruitt or Morgan, would you walk us through the section that has that portion where if I was committed and I now am fighting that adjudication, how do I get this expunged from the record? Could you walk through that and show me where it was? Because it looks like it's Section 3, but you were describing a very lengthy process, and I just, since you introduced this to me yesterday, I haven't found that part.
Absolutely, I can speak to that, and then I might also defer to the drafter to explain some of it.
Also, maybe you just do a hypothetical. Excuse me, somebody walking down the street, something happens, and take it from there.
Sure. So one thing I might mention is that the court, to my understanding, does not actually expunge records. We actually seal them or make them confidential, which is misrepresented in statute. And so one thing that we did when we were going through this is look at those places where that's misstated. But they do seal the records. most of this is dealt with in Section 4. And it looks at the ability of the reviewing court to consider the circumstances de novo much after the fact. But there's also an appeal process that can happen directly within the original proceedings. And I might defer to someone else for more details on that, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson, if you'd like, we could definitely ask Kathleen, who is she helped draft it, and she's very knowledgeable in the subject.
And that would Representative Pruitt speaking.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, that'd be fine to do. One of my questions, I guess, revolves around how do you get this started. So if I have to go to court, you know, do I have to get a lawyer to clear my name? Do I do this myself? Do I just petition the clerk of court, hey, I'd like a trial date? I mean, because it says in ruling on the motion, the court shall consider. So, I mean, it sounds like it's, as you said, how do you get the ball rolling? I don't understand.
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Pruitt, Rep. Isaacson. One of the things that I think an understanding of it, one of the things that we've tried to make sure we do is have all of our lifelines here, and I think Nancy Mead could probably speak to that from the court system, probably a little bit more appropriate and more succinctly than even I could, even with all the detail, the time that we've devoted into this, if that's okay.
That'd be fine. Thank you.
Yeah. Again, it'd be good. Just to give an example how this might apply to Mr. Joe Blow walking down the street, as something happens, and he's taken into custody, and then he goes to a hospital, I suppose, and then this happens, and that happens, and that happens. Could somebody just kind of walk through some guy walking down the street, and something happens?
Yeah, Representative Representative Len, Representative Pruitt. If someone's involuntarily committed, there's a series, we can put a lot of hypotheticals. And I actually, unfortunately, there's probably know of one or two instances of people out there where this is actually taking place. Usually, something has created a situation where they might actually have to either visit a hospital for some sort of reason. Maybe they've gone in because of family has encouraged them to go in. Maybe there was some other potential health reason. I mean, there's several things that could happen. Upon being in there, of course, this is, of course, where we get into where even the HIPAA concerns that, you know, that come about. It could be determined that they should, they probably need a little bit more time for trying to be kind of gentle. And again, I'm trying to reference one example that I am aware of. It was an unfortunate situation. They would then be, it would be requested that they be involuntarily committed.
So one could go in voluntarily.
You
and
can.
And then at that point, they may be kept there involuntarily.
The situation that I'm
thinking
of is what happened.
Involuntarily to begin with.
Yes, they went in because of their their family had suggested that they go in and seek help, and it was determined that they needed time. Now recognize that the 30-day involuntary commitment is a 30-day involuntary commitment. It's 30 days. The intent is not necessarily to keep someone in an institution for the rest of their life. I mean, if you go through if you go through history, in the past, there kind of there's that thought process of years ago where they would throw someone in and you know throw away the key, and that's not what happens today in behavioral health. We don't do that. There is a concerted effort to allow people the opportunity to get back into society to tell you the truth. That's why it's a 30-day involuntary commitment initially. So that person from the experience that I'm thinking of, yeah, they started off with it was a voluntary or their family requested that they seek help, and then from there it was suggested that they seek the involuntary commitment of the individual. And of course the proceedings here, and I don't know once it gets to there, I don't know all the details after that because that is sealed, and I didn't honestly want to dig any deeper into that. There might be someone though from back to either Nancy Mead or potentially of course we have an individual from API on that might be able to speak a little bit more to that, but that's just the experience that from someone that I knew, kind of what came from them. I'm sure there's multiple ways in which an individual could end up with that involuntary.
So at what point in the process would a report be made to Nick?
It would only be official after the final adjudication was handed down from the judge, which basically when someone is taken in for an assessment of this case, there is a period that they are detained, and at that point they have not been adjudicated, but they also would not be available to go out and purchase a firearm at that time. And they could also be cleared of whatever the consideration was and not be committed. And so none of that would ever go to NICS. It would only be once the final adjudication point was reached at the end. In Anchorage, I know that there are some hearings that are handled by a master who then passes on their recommendation to a judge, but the final recommendation is the point at which this registers. And that was one of the points that we cleared up with the courts. They were looking for a more definitive point, of course, at which they would transmit the records.
Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have three questions. The first two, I hope, are short answers. You've mentioned 30 days a few times, so I'm wondering, is that the minimum amount of involuntary commitment, or is that at the point where they hit the 30 days, that when the records would be passed on? What is, can you just explain the 30 days, please?
The 30 days is the minimum amount of time of being involuntarily committed that would trigger them for this situation, but the actual records would be transmitted at the point of adjudication that determined that they would need that time in an institution.
Okay, follow up. And so there are involuntary commitments that are less than 30 days that wouldn't trigger the transfer of the records, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes. I might defer to someone else for that. My understanding is that 30 days is the minimum to trigger someone for this, but I'm not aware of circumstances otherwise that people would be in for shorter periods of time, so we may go to someone else for that.
The word trigger was an unintended pun. I just thought I'd point that out. Next question. I'm looking up at the map of the states. You mentioned Texas has over 200,000 records in the NICS system, but they haven't enacted a legislation only I think 8 states have or something. I think you, I heard that yesterday, although there's less than that in blue. So we, in our state, we need to change statute in order to do that, but in some of these other states that didn't have to change statute, they were able to just transfer the records. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there are 25 states that have some sort of transmittal process, and sometimes it's transmitted to a state database, sometimes it's transmitted directly to NICS. It varies between state to state, but the ones who you do see information reported for, especially the higher numbers, are ones that have reporting to state and then NICS or directly. So actually the number is a little higher at 25 states.
Through the chair, Representative Perotta, Representative Hughes, I believe the 8 that you're referring to is the, there's, my understanding is there are eight states, of which Alaska is one, that does not communicate anything to the NICS database, and we are one of those 8, I believe is probably where you're, what you're referring to with the 8 states.
And follow up, so the sponsor of the bill, some of these states have not enacted legislation, but they're transferring records right now to NICS. So I'm going to, is it correct to assume that they didn't need to enact legislation, but Alaska does in order to do this?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, this is Representative Pruitt again. At this time we do not. And part of the reason is if you look at the actual statute that for which we're changing in this particular case with a 30-day, the 30-day involuntary commitment, there is a provision in there that indicates that those hearings are totally and completely closed. And the only way that they can be currently in the current statute, the only way that they can be the information could be released is really actually it's voluntary. The family can determine if they want it to be a public or if they do not want it to be public. What we have to do in this case to be able to communicate this information to the NICS database is make a slight provision in there that allows for just this limited information to be communicated to the NICS database, continuing to maintain the security and the privacy for that individual and their family. So this is not something that will be public. It's not something that you're going to be able to just access. But we had to make a slight change to allow those normally closed, you know, and think about it. If you're the family of an individual who is in this scenario, and you have the choice to either make it public or to make it private, 9 times out of 10, I would expect, maybe even 9.5 times out of 10, they're probably going to go ahead and remain public or private in that circumstance, which in my view is very appropriate. What we're doing is we're just indicating in this case is if they, and this is where the slight change in the statute needs to come from, that this limited information can be sent to the NICS database based on the final adjudication of the individual. So okay. It does require that.
Thank you. Follow-up. So you answered my 30-day question, the need for enacting legislation compared to other states. So the third one, there was something that kind of concerned me in that when you were talking about the courts changing the word expunge to seal, that the courts haven't been expunging, yet that was in the statute. And expunge, of course, means, you know, to delete, erase, blot out, or whatever, as opposed to seal. So I, if you could discuss why we're sealing rather than expunging, and perhaps Nancy could speak to that, why they weren't being expunged prior. Are they sometimes, do they go back and get them again if circumstances arises, or just explain why we're sealing rather than expunging?
Mr. Chair, I would defer Representative Hughes to Nancy, as she is
We'll ask her as soon as she comes up here. Ask her. Representative Keller.
On that topic, if I could, Representative Pruitt, are you comfortable? It seems like a state, I'm with the asker of the last question. Are you comfortable with if it is a decrease in the standard of what is supposed to happen that we're putting down in law? Would you rather stick with expunge if that's a possibility, or, you know, I mean, I'm sure we'll get more information in that question, may get answered as we go. You don't have to answer, but my question was, as I read that, it looks like we're changing the standard. It looks like right now it can be expunged, and if they're saying, if the courts are saying, no, we don't do that, well, then, of course, the follow-up question is, why not? you know. I mean, we, you know, and there's probably a really good reason. I'm eager to hear it, you know, and I don't, but I just, the question I was putting before you is that if you had the choice between expunge and seal, do you have a preference?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, this is Representative Pruitt again. So let me start with the actual discussion related to the whether it's expunged or sealed was not, to tell you the truth, something that we were initially, you know, kind of tweaking in some capacity, to tell you the truth. We were not looking at, I guess, a discussion on whether or not someone could eventually be expunged from this. That wasn't really part of the initial purview. As we look to ensure that someone could not have this on, you know, not have a lifetime, you know, name on the database, that's when we started looking at how do we go about the particular process of making sure that there is an ability to remove their name from it. So I'd have to ask, you know, defer to Nancy on exactly what takes place now, but I know that we weren't looking at tweaking with whether or not currently their information can be expunged or whether or not it's normally sealed, because we weren't getting into it. We were just trying to ensure that their name could be removed from, that there was a process that could remove their name from the list itself. What they're currently doing, I think we'd probably have to get a better feel from the
okay, follow up, and then we're going to go to Nancy Mead after this.
Yeah, if I could, and if it's okay with the sponsor, could I ask the drafter, Kathleen Strasburg, a question? She's online.
Ms. Strasburg, are you there?
On this point.
Through the chair, that'd be great.
I am.
Please introduce yourself.
Kathleen Strasburg, Legislative Legal Services, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Reverend Keller.
Yeah, Kathleen, as I was looking at Section 3, the question that came to my mind is why that's in there. You know, the intent of the sponsor was to make sure that this could be, you know, erased. It just seems like it's been added in as an, you know, adding to what the sponsor wanted. And I would like to know how you decided to include Section 3.
Well, this paragraph 2, the new paragraph, the subparagraph one, if that has been in there, it ties this statute seemed to be the best vehicle for providing a method for someone to ask the court not only to seal their record, but also to go on then and ask for the process that is in the next subsection, which is a new subsection. It wasn't the decision about whether to remove expunging or sealing was at the request of the court, because it is their practice to seal. They have rules about it, but again, I'm not the one that should explain that.
Vice Chair Keller?
Yeah, just really curious about the process. Did the courts contact you, or did you contact the courts on this?
You would have to discuss that with a sponsor.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that's through the chair.
Okay, just one quick follow-up, because it looks like on the records right now that if anyone, you can move to have all court records expunged, you know, and if we're finding out that that's not happening or that wasn't an option, then it has to raise the question, you know, okay, will they be sealed? You know, I mean, in other words, if the standard isn't being followed, you know, and that's fine. We'll hear from the courts on it. I just was curious with your response. Thank you.
Well, basically, Mr. Chairman, Representative Culler, the first Section 850 is the process by which you request the sealing, and then 851, the new one, is the process for seeking relief from disability. So there are two separate opportunities for the petitioner.
Thank you.
Thank you. please hang around there. Let's go to Nancy Mead. I believe you're in the audience someplace. Good morning. We've been seeing a lot of each other recently.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and let me try to address the...
You've heard some of the discussion about expunged versus sealed and other matters.
Yes.
Would you just comment on that now that we can ask questions after that?
Certainly. First, there was a question about whether there are commitments that are for less than 30 days. The answer is yes. Most of the commitments are three-day commitments, and we have many of those filed every year. We're up to about 2,500 a year being filed for three-day commitments and evaluations. That's an evaluation period. Thereafter, the process is that the master in Anchorage or judges in other locations where they don't have masters considers the evidence and the evaluations provided by the medical facilities and determines whether a longer-term commitment is appropriate under the circumstances. There can be 30-day commitments and 90-day commitments. This bill would only require the court to report to DPS the longer term, the 30-day and over. Those, we only have a couple of hundred filed every year, and about half of those are granted. So those are the kind of numbers that we're talking about from what I've seen in our data. So I hope that's helpful. Second, there was a question about the expunging versus sealing. I want to be clear that Section 3, the statute that exists now, already is either expunge or seal option, as the court considers appropriate under the circumstances. That would be page 3, lines 16 through 18. So the current statute allows the court to order either expungement or sealing, again, whichever the court considers appropriate. To date, we first of all, this statute is extremely rarely used by somebody. These cases are already confidential. Mental health commitment cases are confidential, meaning they aren't on court view, that they aren't accessible to the public. Confidential records, according to our definitions that are used throughout the court system, are available only to the parties and the attorneys and court personnel for case processing purposes, and of course the judge. That's confidential. That's what all these cases are from the get-go. A person can move to have their records sealed or expunged under this statute when they're discharged from a treatment facility or their petition for commitment is denied. Again, very rarely used, and the courts do order sealing when it's requested rather than expungement. The definition of sealing is much more restrictive than confidential. Sealed records are accessible only to the judge and somebody with a court order, not to the judge's assistant, not to the law clerks, not to the court clerk, not to anybody. Sealed records are kept sealed forever. They aren't imaged and put on microfiche like many of our other records after a certain retention period. The specific answer to the question that Representative Keller asked, why aren't they expunged? The reason for that is more of a process reason. The petitioner's purposes are fully served by sealing. Those cases essentially disappear. What would be different with expungement rather than sealing is that we would, I suppose, we don't do this, physically shred all the documents related to the issue. We don't do that just because of the sort of philosophy that something about what happened ought to be retained for some possible reason, that destroying records is contrary to most court policies. Again, the sealed records achieve what the person needs. They're not accessible to anybody, just the judge. And after a case is over, of course, even the judge doesn't have reason to go back. So that's the reason that I believe the current statute allows for either, but typically we don't expunge. Now, in working with the sponsor, and I do want to thank the sponsor's office very much for addressing some of the court's concerns about process and ensuring that it's something everybody can implement. I mentioned that, well, it's almost a cleanup. The current statute does allow the court the option. We only do the one, so it might be good to expunge the word expunge, and that was done. If you want to leave it in there, For other purposes, you could still give the court the option. I will say that since we don't have a procedure for literally shredding court records, that's why the court typically orders sealing when somebody makes the request under this statute. And I hope that addresses the question.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, just one. Has the court ever expunged records?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, no.
On any subject?
That's my understanding, correct.
And as a follow-up.
Reverend Isaac, and then Hughes.
So as a follow-up to what you're just saying, appreciate you being here, Nancy. What I heard you say is the court could expunge if it had procedures. So who is responsible for the procedures? Is it the legislature or is it the court to develop the expunging procedure?
Well, I think the answer to that is the court would develop procedures because it would be procedure. If there were a statute that said the court must expunge X, the court would need to implement that by developing procedures for doing so.
As a follow-up, then.
Follow-up.
But what I heard you say is that the court does not expunge because it doesn't have a procedure to do so. But if we have in statute that it should be expunged, then you would have to develop procedures for that, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, that's correct. And as I say, this statute allows the court the option, whichever it considers appropriate. So it hasn't been interpreted as requiring expungement, and therefore, because of the policy of maintaining some record for sort of archival purposes, we don't expunge currently.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. If it is the intent of the legislature that individuals should have the right to expunge, but the court doesn't have the procedure to do it, you're intimating that perhaps instead of adopting the CS, we should amend the current bill and just say delete the words at the discretion or under the whichever the court considers appropriate under the circumstances. If that's a convenient way for the court to say, well, we don't have a procedure, and so the intent of actually deleting a file, getting rid of its ability to ever show its face again for any reason, and we all know the breach of security happens and people's private information gets released under certain circumstances, unfortunate circumstances. Is that the course that we need to take then, if we are feeling that some records actually should be destroyed?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, it would be up to the legislature if you want to say that some records should be destroyed. That would be a statute that you could indeed enact. I guess I would just say that sealing does accomplish all the purposes of expungement, and so if you pass that statute, we would implement procedures. I hope that answers the question.
And does this go to the heart of the bill, which is, under certain circumstances, reporting to NIC? Does this affect that one way or the other?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it does. That statute has existed for quite a while and is available to folks right now who are released from a treatment facility or whose petition for involuntary commitment was denied. As I mentioned, it's very rarely taken advantage of. People don't ask. Again, their records are already confidential. So going the next step, people, I don't know if they've just not seen the need to go to the next step towards sealing or expungement.
It's not one of this goes to the heart of the bill, or are we getting into the weeds on potential future legislation?
To me, it doesn't go to the heart of the bill. I guess that would be up to the sponsor to determine whether or not he believes that this is one of the crucial aspects of the bill.
Okay. Representative Isaacson, and then we're going to Representative Hughes.
Okay, just as a follow-up, just to be sure, you mentioned that sealing accomplishes the same results of expunging, but expunging means to destroy, correct? If the court expunged a record, would they actually shred it, burn it, do something, incinerate, get rid of it forever? Or is expunging means it's going down to some dark archive to be lost until somebody in the distant future as an archaeologist surfaces these documents?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I think that's something the court would have to work out. If there were something that said the court must expunge, we would have to figure out whether that means burning or shredding, or whether it means sealing. But I guess it would be a step beyond sealing. So that would be my initial reaction. But I think that we'd have to work out what those procedures, how to implement a statute like that. And I'd just say that sometimes there are doing things retroactively and finding all the pieces and expunging might present some sort of workability problems. But again, it's up to you whether you want to put that in the statute, and the court would figure it out.
So, Mr. Chair, the reason why I keep on asking on this, it goes back to my original question, which had to do with how does somebody get rid of this record? And for some reason, you know, whether you're in retail or whether you're in government or you're in business, private things tend to get leaked out again. And if it could be accidentally, if the intent is to remove a record from the NIX, then I would think we'd want to destroy the record, period, unless mitigating circumstances. But if we are saying somebody should not be on that and have tried to destroy that record, if the record isn't destroyed, but it's just sitting sealed someplace that somebody accidentally brings forward. I mean, I had a fellow in my office yesterday who, with workman's comp claims, is getting other people's medical records sent to him. I mean, these accidents happen. So my whole issue is, whether or not expunge actually means to destroy, or if expunge means to seal, then why do we have the option expunge or seal? If the intent is to get rid, expunge, of a record, it should be destroyed. So to me, it is still in the heart of the intent and the heart of the matter. If we're reporting something and we're trying to allow someone to redress this issue that they should not be on the NIX system, how do we make sure that if the court says, okay, we're removing your name, that the name never gets back on, unless it has a new circumstance?
And I would suppose, too, that if it is reported to NIC, they're going to have a copy of this. Do they seal it or expunge it at the NIC level?
I don't know.
It'd be fine to seal it or expunge it here, but so what if NIC has it in some filing cabinet?
And through the chair, it's just, I guess it may be a minutia, it may be the rare circumstance, but this whole idea is, you know, people have inalienable rights. We've involuntarily removed those rights, as it were, because we committed them. And if there's a reversal of that commitment, and said, whoops, we goofed, you shouldn't have been involuntarily committed, or the circumstances or whatever
are such.
Yeah, it's such that you shouldn't be on this NIX list. You should have your rights to bear arms again. I'm just concerned that, you know, we don't have these records showing up when they shouldn't. That was.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, these records, again, sealing is highly, highly confidential. The court has not had breaches of sealed document protocols. We haven't had sealed documents go out in the past. I understand your concern that could happen. But I would also point out that this would be for sealing or expunging in two situations, Section 3. That is, when a person is discharged from a treatment facility, or there's a court order denying the petition for commitment. So it's not tied to Section 4, the report, or 5, the reports to NICS, or the relief from disability action that can happen. So you can get your court files sealed or expunged under Section 3 only for those two things, when you're released from a facility or an order denying a petition for commitment. Now, when that happens, there are others in state government who have records of those. For example, API, the public defender who's appointed, the other attorneys that are involved in one of the involuntary commitments. And I believe it's been the court's policy that since this happened, there are records of it elsewhere, there are tendrils, and should the court expunge, i.e. burn or shred its records, there could be an issue with later on, for example, a public defender wanting to go back, or API, or some reason. So the security of having those documents, albeit sealed, somewhere in the court's archives is, I think, helpful to the entire process for the future. And that is why the court wants to not absolutely get rid of things. But again, that would be the legislature's call, and we could figure it out. But there would be ramifications of that. And
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I hear Nancy saying the unintended consequence of, one, the court destroying a record, unless they have ordered all records destroyed, and that might be something that goes into other statute, other law, federal requirements, et cetera. And so it might be better just to leave it as sealed, which then speaks to the CS. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to go to Representative Hughes next, and then I do have somebody from FBI and Nick's online, but we'll get your question first.
Oh, good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully they'll be able to let us know what they do if they're removed here at our end, what happens at the Nick's end. I realize, and the sponsor probably didn't guess that this little expunge versus seal would be a question, and I still have a question about it, although I understand the tendrils piece, because you mentioned that right now the courts have a choice, an option, whether it's expunge or seal, but I don't see that here, so that obviously must be somewhere else, I mean, you know, prior to this change. And in addition, I was thinking you could have an 18 or 19-year-old who is suicidal and a danger to himself, and he is involuntarily committed for the 30 days. So he's in the system, and 25 years later, he is totally, fully, very healthy, and yet this would be carried so on this person. And I have a concern about the privacy and things being leaked as well, even though you say that the courts have a very good record, and I'm happy to hear that. I'm just thinking, too, sounds like these are paper copies, and you've always sealed everything, so I'm guessing there's volume, so and so if you could clarify whether they are paper and whether, I mean, it seems like it'd be a bit unyieldy to be preserving everything since statehood or whenever it all began. So if you could talk to address that. And then my last part, I'm bringing it all so I don't have to ask a series of questions, is can a person right now request that the records be expunged versus sealed? And then you don't have a procedure, so what would happen if that's the case? And then the final thing is, since you have records sealed, have there been instances of the records being unsealed, and what is the process for unsealing? So we have a sense of, it would help us, I believe, understand that it might be important to have them, allow them to be sealed as opposed to being expunged. Thank you.
Yeah, you got all that?
No, I'm not sure I do, but I will make an attempt through the chair, Representative Hughes. First, if you look at page 3, lines 16 to 18, that is where the option exists in the statute now. You can see the last sentence of the statute in Section 3, upon the filing of the motion, the court shall order the court records either expunged or sealed, whichever the court can. So there is the option right now, so that I might have been your first question. Secondly, we have a very strict difference in the court system between confidential and sealed. These records now are confidential because they involve mental health issues. And confidential records are kept in separate envelopes, and they are, you have bright orange tape, like, clerk, don't hand this across the counter, or something fluorescent, and they don't appear at all on court view. At the end of a case, when the record retention period is over, so after a couple of years in the courthouse sitting on the confidential shelf, they get sent to our administrative archive section for imaging. Confidential files can be imaged. Now, that's different from sealed. And this statute gives the person who's the subject of a petition for a mental commitment the option to come into the court and ask to have it sealed. Sealed is much more restrictive. The only people with access, as I mentioned, is the judge, not even the judge's secretary. And the judge would therefore seal it. It's taped, and those are retained, yes, in paper form. We don't keep electronic records yet, in perpetuity. And it's rare to have sealed documents. We hardly ever have them, and it is a burdensome, I would say, for the court system to process sealed cases. But when somebody asks and are entitled to do it, it's done. As I say, it's quite rare. There are other situations, obviously, other than mental health, where documents can be sealed as well. Those are kept in paper forever. They're kept in I'm sure we purchase storage space somewhere to do it. And the process for getting it opened, I believe, was your next question. A person could, we have rules about gaining access to non-public case files. It's usually confidential cases that say the media wants access to, and there is a court rule, Administrative Rule 37.6, about how to do that and what the court considers. It's a balancing test of the person's privacy, and clearly if there's a statute or rule that says something is confidential, there's a heightened sense of privacy versus the requester's reason for accessing those cases, and there are factors that the judge would have to consider. For example, the passage of time, maybe 20 years later, and it's a case of public interest or something like that. Again, that is not very often used, but there is a way to do it. To my knowledge, access to a sealed document would not happen more than once every, or a petition to access a sealed document would be extremely rare. I would guess, without knowing the data on that, that there would not be one a year. And again, very few documents are sealed because that's so strict, but out of those, it'd be very rare for somebody to try to access the sealed document. So,
follow-up.
Ready to follow.
So you mentioned a person can request that they be sealed, but right now a person can't request that they be expunged.
Well, they can use the statute and say, can I have it sealed or expunged? And the court, as a matter of practice, can order sealing. Again, I'm going to say there's a handful of those a year. And
Okay, Reverend Keller, then I'm going to go to the FBI.
Thank you. And I want to thank the chair for letting us work on this. This bill does not go to the judiciary. This is probably a judiciary question. I also want to thank Nancy for you're always straight with your answers, and I really appreciate it, and you're very, very honest. I want to ask the process, because I'm trying to figure this out. The sponsor, I think, indicated, and I don't mean to speak for him at all, any way, shape, or form, but I think he indicated that his concern was that there was an appeal process to make sure that this record didn't stand on there. And then in the process of the drafting, which has always been a bit of a mystery to me, we get this back, a section of law that really has nothing to do directly with the intent of the sponsor, as I understood his intent.
Okay? That's what I was saying.
And I'm thinking, I'm sitting here wondering, now, how did that happen? I mean, did we get language from Ledge Legal that made you contact our legal services and discuss it with them, or did the sponsor contact you? That's one question. The other question is, you indicated that 850 goes with 851. 851 says nothing about sealing or expunging. It says a relief. The work of art, or term of art, I should say, is relief. Relief from records. Is relief from records equal to sealing? I mean, in other words, it to me, that's not plain English. As I read 851, I wouldn't know that I have the right to, request that the information be sealed. So if you would throw some light on that too.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, first to clarify, if I misspoke, I'm sorry, but to me, Section 3 and Section 4 don't go together. Section 3 has been on the books for some time. I don't know when it was put there. And Section 4 would be a brand new, basically, court process that a person could go through. So those are two different things, and indeed Section 3 doesn't say that you can get your records sealed or expunged if you received a relief from disability under Section 4. To me, they're completely separate. Let me go backwards, though, to your initial comment. The process for how this happened was the sponsor's office kindly contacted me to make sure that, you know, I had seen the bill. I think this is how it happened, and wanted to make sure, okay, courts can do this, right, before we introduce it, which was, I was very gratified to know that I would be asked. And I mentioned a few things after talking to our staff who deals with mental commitments that could be improved in my mind. For example, where the court must immediately transmit certain information to the Department of Public Safety, I pointed out the practical problem that the court doesn't, the prior version had said the court must immediately transmit the person's name, date of birth, address, social security number. I pointed out we don't always know it. Sometimes the folks that are involuntarily committed are in not such good shape, might not have family members, maybe living on the streets, for example. So that was a comment that I brought up to the sponsor's staff and realized, well, all we can do is report things we know. So, for example, the phrase, if known, was added to the bill. That makes it that we can comply to the extent possible. So those are the sorts of things that I brought up, making sure that there was a triggering event that after which the court must immediately transmit, because there are stages through the involuntary commitment. When it came to this section, I mentioned to the sponsor that that, you know, as long as you're in there, you should know the court has not historically expunged. It says expunged or sealed, and it might be cleaner to have the statute reflect what can be done. And kindly, again, the drafter, the sponsor's office, put that change into the CS. Again, that is not closely related to the intent of the bill, and it's up to you whether you want to have that change in Section 3. So that's how the process worked. And I think I'll mention one thing about the actual process of involuntary mental commitments. What often happens, and you have knowledgeable people on the phone too, is the police come because a family can't handle a family member, or somebody is out of control in some way and doesn't have their faculties about them, and the police bring the person to API or to some facility for evaluation. And initially, there's the determination made whether they need to be evaluated, and they can be involuntarily committed for that three-day evaluation period during which doctors and psychiatrists become involved. After that, an assessment is made, and the person is appointed a lawyer if they can't afford a lawyer. And there are lawyers on all sides, and it's brought forth to the judicial officer, who then decides whether a longer-term commitment is appropriate for this individual. And it's only if that is decided yes, and if when the judicial officer makes that determination that 30 days or more is required, that, again, the court would be required to report that to DPS under my reading of the bill. Section 4 is brand new, and this would happen, as my fiscal note says, I believe quite rarely. The meat of the bill is Section 5, the report to DPS so that they can report it to NICS. But Section 4 is shouldn't be viewed as an appeal procedure, but a relief procedure. So sometime way after this person has been reported to NICS, reported by the court to DPS, by DPS to NICS, the person feels that he or she has fully recovered from the whatever mental problem that initiated the initial problem. So when they're fully recovered, they would come back to the court, begin a new legal action, and say, I have this thing going on with DPS and NICS, and I want to be relieved from it. I would imagine a good period of time would have had to pass so that they could prove that they are not a threat to public safety anymore. And that person would have a burden of coming in and asking the court to undo the disability that they're suffering because of having been reported to DPS and NICS. And the statute spells out quite specifically what the court would consider and look at, and when they might grant relief relief from those disabilities. Disabilities, of course, being the inability to purchase or own guns through NICS. So that would, again, happen at a much later stage. And I don't see in Section 4 anything about sealing or expunging. So I hope that helps with the process explanation.
I think it does. Representative Keller wants to make a statement.
Yeah, I just want to say that I made a mistake. It is referred to judiciary, and thank you for your answer.
Mr. Chair, real quick.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. I appreciate you walking us through that, Nancy. That goes exactly to what my first question was. Someone was involuntarily committed. They couldn't afford an attorney. If they have been in that situation and now they are trying to have Section 4 kick in, will the court then appoint them an attorney so that they can fight this or seek the relief?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I think not. I think when people are involuntarily committed, they are appointed a public defender if they don't have the if they are indigent. And also, by the way, this can apply to people who are accused of crimes and whose defense is a mentally incompetent to stand trial. So they would have a public defender or their own attorney in connection with that criminal prosecution. So the an attorney would be appointed for the involuntary commitment or the criminal case, but then the years later, for example, and I mean, I don't know how much later, but some subsequent time when the person comes in to be relieved from disability under Section 4, there would be no attorney appointed the way I read the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to go now to, looks like Sherry Baker. Oh, I beg your pardon.
No worries.
But I've got to get this person online pretty soon. Go ahead. Make it short.
Well, and I'll try to make as I sit here listening back and forth, and I understand the intent of the bill is to take to not allow folks with mental patients, if you will, to purchase guns that they can hurt somebody else with. So I get that part. But what comes to mind is if I think of somebody who has a chemical imbalance, somebody who has postpartum depression to the extreme, but so that they get the help that they need, and they get it relatively quickly, but after 30 days, their name goes in, and now they have to, when I hear you talk about years later, I mean, you could be into I guess this is an exception to the rule, but years later, you still have to wait that length of time to be deemed competent and then go through a process with attorneys and whatever just to buy a gun again when you've been found that you had a chemical imbalance, and you're really, once they've balanced the chemical, you're pretty much good to go. And so I'm really struggling with the fact that I understand the intent of the bill, and I understand it would be my thought that it's a way to keep folks with mental disabilities from purchasing guns and doing bad things with guns. But what happens when somebody has a, for lack of a better word, a temporary mental disability? Boy, this can go on and on forever.
Through the chair, Representative Gattas, first I should have put earlier on the record, the court is neutral as to the policy in this bill. Mm-hmm. That sounds like maybe a consideration for the sponsor and for you all to consider the wisdom of doing this, because there could be many different circumstances. And again, I just want to state that we're neutral, but I am grateful to the sponsor to making sure whatever's written was something that we could implement. I will say that I said years later, but that was that there's no time period before which a person would be entitled to ask for this relief from disability. They could, in an individualized circumstance, ask at any time, and perhaps the court would grant it. You'll see at the bottom of page 3 and 4 that there are definite things the court considers. The bottom of page 3, the time that has elapsed since the involuntary commitment is one of the factors the court would look at. It would be, there's a hearing, and it would be, as I read Section 4, a very individualized determination of whether this person is no longer a threat to public safety. And so there is, it's not formulaic, but there are definite things the court has to consider. Time is just one of those.
Thank you. I want to go to Sherry Baker. Are you online?
Yes, I am.
Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony and or comments.
Okay. Sherry Baker. I'm the NICS Index Liaison Specialist here at the FBI NICS Section.
And you're in West Virginia, I see.
Yes, I am, and the sun's shining today. I would like to say that in answer to a lot of your concerns, I think I can kind of make things a little bit clearer. The FBI does not want any medical records. We only have three required fields, which are name, date of birth, and sex, for entry into the NICS Index. Additional identifiers, as SOSH, which are in the bill, those are an added plus because several people do have same name, same date of birth, and we run into that a lot where people will be misidentified if you don't have enough identifiers in the database. But yes, just name, date of birth, and sex, and no medical records. The only thing that is required, though, by each data source is that the agency entering the information is responsible for ensuring the accuracy and validity upon audit of the information that's submitted to the NICS Index. So whenever you talk about the expunging and sealing of the records, if the records are sealed, that works. Expunging would not, because there has to be the supporting documentation housed somewhere, so that on down the road, if there is an appeal and there needs to be a court order for information, it needs to still exist. The information can't go in the NICS Index without there being supporting documentation to back it up. So I hope that kind of helps with that. As well as the release process, that's the great thing about for the people that do get involuntary commitments for treatment and have your 30-day or more involuntary commitments, by offering them that relief, that does give them the option whenever they are sane or are of sound mind and do want to get their rights back, then that will take them out of the NICS Index. But then under the Safe Explosives Act, they will just remain in the database for explosive purposes only. So whenever it comes to a background check for a firearm, that's the only time that the database is accessed. No one else can have access to the information, and no one will see that information except for that occasion. But they will be retained for explosives purposes if they do receive relief.
What kind of purposes did you say?
Pardon me?
What kind of purposes?
Explosive.
Just for firearms. If an FFL, Federal Firearms License dealer, is conducting a background check for purchase, possession, pawn of a firearm, that's the only time that database is searched. The information is not even disclosed to the firearms license dealer. Not even to our call center. They just will delay a firearm background check. It comes to our examiners, and they make the determination. They all have top secret clearance. They will process the transaction and make the decision on whether that person can purchase, possess, or pawn, and just will provide the Federal Firearms License dealer with that end answer of whether they are proceed or deny. They don't disclose any other information to the Federal Firearms License dealer, and then that's the end of the transaction.
Fine. Any questions, Ms. Baker? Very good. Thank you for your testimony. You cleared up some things.
Sure.
I'm going to go hang around. We probably have some more questions here. I'm probably going to mispronounce your name, Jake McGuigan. Are you online, sir?
Yes, Chair, that is Jake McGuigan.
McGuigan?
Yes, sir.
Very good. Please identify yourself and give us your comments.
Great. Good morning, Chair Lynn and members of the committee. My name is Jake McGuigan. I'm Director of State Affairs for the National Shooting Sports Foundation. We're the trade association for the firearms industry, and we represent over 10,000 retailers, manufacturers, and distributors nationwide, and over 50 companies alone right there in Alaska. Our industry in Alaska contributes 600 jobs, $68 million of economic impact, and $7 million of taxes to the state of Alaska. I'd first like to thank Representative Pruitt for sponsoring this legislation and also this committee for taking up the topic and having an open discussion concerning the impacts and ramifications of this fix-nix legislation. We as a firearms industry have seen one common denominator among many of these horrific tragedies that have occurred here in the past, whether it's Newtown, Aurora, Tucson, or Virginia Tech. It is a mental health component. And unfortunately, we've seen across this country not much being done to really address this. And really, I'm calling from Connecticut. They passed a very, very strict gun control law here in Connecticut, yet cut many millions of dollars to mental health funding in the state, which really should have been more addressed. So that's why the industry has developed this Fix-Nix initiative. We represent manufacturers across the country like Smith & Wesson, Ruger, Mossberg, Beretta, and all firearms and all ammunition manufacturers like Winchester and Federal. So they have our board of directors, run by the heads of these companies, decided to address this Fix-Nix initiative. And as you can see by my written testimony, I have updates on how we've progressed across the country. And then also, I believe I included a map in there as well to show really where legislation has been enacted and where we're also addressing concerns in the states which are not submitting those records. One of the most recent successes was just last week in South Dakota, where the General Assembly and the Senate passed the bill and is now sitting on the governor's desk waiting for his signature. And it passed overwhelmingly in the Senate. It was a 26-9 vote, and in the House it was a 53-17 vote. So really, as an industry, the last thing that we want to have happen is to have individuals that are federally prohibited from owning a firearm gaining access to that. And that's why this situation in Alaska and in some of the other states like North Dakota, South Dakota, and Oklahoma, we are trying to address this. We as a firearms industry have taken some heat for this stance. There are some groups out there, firearms groups, that have not been happy with our stance and how we are and what we are doing with this Fix-Nix initiative.
Would you indicate who some of those people might be?
There are some other groups, some in-state groups. Gun Owners of America have been opposed to our initiatives. We have worked very closely with the NRA on this bill and on bills in many other states, namely South Dakota. We have worked very closely on passing that legislation. So we as an industry and NRA have worked closely to draft this and have been in full consultation on this.
With the NRA?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
One of our concerns, and one of the NRA's concerns, is that we don't want to see any further expansion of prohibited people. We want those that are federally prohibited right now to be in the system, but we're not looking to expand those categories at all. What we want to make sure is that those that are prohibited are in the system. We don't want to discourage anyone from getting treatment. No matter what you hear in opposition to this bill will not force anyone or stop anyone from seeking treatment or seeking help for any of their problems or concerns. The last thing that we want is a veteran that's returning from overseas who may have PTSD not getting the appropriate treatment because he's afraid of losing his firearms rights. And that is not what we want to do, and that's not what we're pushing in this situation. So we want to make sure that that is one area which is addressed. And the other area which I know have been discussed at length here is really the restoration of rights. We want to make sure that an individual who goes through the process can get his rights restored either in the near future or further down the line. We don't want anyone to lose their Second Amendment rights because of involuntarily committed and then end up, you know, becoming healthy and going through the process to restore those rights. So those are the really two major concerns that we have along with the NRA on legislation like this. And really, we as a firearms industry are always getting chastised or yelled at when we have these situations dealing with there has to be common ground. This is one area that does not impact any instruments, any firearms, any ammunition, where this may be an area where there is common ground, where that those who are federally prohibited are in the system. And just to address a question that was earlier from one of the representatives, Nebraska was a state that we recently fixed and made sure that the records were sent to the NICS system. They had the law in place for the past 3 years, but there was an administrative problem there where we need to address that and make sure that the departments were working together and transmitting the records to NICS. So there are situations nationwide where it could be an administrative fix, it could be a legislative fix, Alaska being one of them where we need to fix it through legislation. So, and as you can see on that map, all the green states are states that have been submitting them for many years. They've already had the process in place and they've been submitting them as well. The red states are where there are states that are not submitting any records at all, really, where Alaska is one of the worst offenders when it comes to that. So that's really just the background of the Fix NICS initiative from the firearms industry, and I'd be happy to take any questions on how we progressed in other states. Really, the first state that we went into last year was Louisiana, and we passed the bill down there in 92-2 in the House, 38-0 in the Senate, and Governor Jindal signed it the first day it was on his desk. And if we look to Louisiana, they are not a state that takes their firearms or Second Amendment rights very lightly. So I appreciate the time the chair has given me, and I appreciate the time the members of the committee has given me as well. So I'd be happy to answer any questions on that.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jake, thanks for being on the phone and clarifying some of these issues from the firearms industry's perspective. You mentioned what is in the back of my mind, and I am in an area where there is a lot of military members in my community, and so the PTSD is a big issue. And so when you mention that they may not want to be in treatment, my question would be, and you said no, this wouldn't affect them as much. My question would be, how long is PTSD treatment usually take? Maybe if you know from your experience in other states, is the 30-day limit okay, or should we be going after a 90-day limit? Or and I guess maybe this might be a question for judiciary when it gets there. But that would be my biggest concern: is how if someone is affected, do they get expunged or in this case sealed? What's the experience in other states on that?
In the other states where you have addressed this, that has not come up to been a major problem, because when you look at a veteran either going through the VA or going through the appropriate medical process to get treatment, they are not involuntarily committed. We are dealing with, if a veteran comes home and wants to go to a facility, that is a voluntary situation. They are not in a, where, you know, they're not going before a court, they are not being involuntarily committed. So there's a big difference between involuntarily committed and obviously a voluntarily committed. So they are taking the steps to get the proper treatment. And in a lot of the states that we have addressed this, the mental health community has supported this legislation. There are states in the Northeast which obviously quote some of the HIPAA requirements that say that HIPAA does not allow them to send those records to NICS, which is not the case. The president has put out a order saying that that was not a violation of HIPAA. And in a state like Massachusetts, where we're addressing this through legislation, we have support from everyone within the mental health community, both on the state level and the national level in Massachusetts. So that was a situation where they were claiming a HIPAA violation when in fact it was not the case. So to kind of go back to your question, anyone who is going to voluntarily seek treatment would not be impacted by this legislation.
Thank you. I see that Nancy Mead has to go to another interesting committee. Any final question for her? Because this bill is eventually going to Judiciary Committee, and I'm sure she will be called upon there to testify. So if I'd like to thank you for your testimony so far this morning. Any questions for McGuigan, Mr. McGuigan?
No,
Thank you very much, sir, for your testimony. I have several other people here online for questions only. Did anybody who signed up for questions only would like to testify? I don't hear a chorus. So anybody in the audience?
Mr. Chair, you have someone from API?
I have somebody from API, yes.
Melissa Ring?
Melissa, do you have a question for her?
I do, if you'd allow.
Ms. Ring, are you online?
Yes, I am. This is Melissa Ring from Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
Yeah, what's your position there?
I'm the CEO.
Okay, that works. Reverend Isaacson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Melissa, you just heard Jake talk about the issue with PTSD and such. In the Alaska experience, how many times does a voluntary person who goes in for voluntary treatment become an involuntary type of a situation that might be affected by this bill?
First of all, I'd like to say that I am new to Alaska. I've been here just, but I have been studying our numbers. We've had, during the fiscal year of 2013, we had about 1,500 people that were admitted on an ex parte order, which is that three-day evaluation period. Of those, we had 140 that we filed for a 30-day petition on. So we filed for a 30-day commitment on about on 140. And of those, in calendar year 2013, just 40 of them actually were committed. So that gives you a sense of the numbers that we're talking about. In terms of people who initially came in as a voluntary person, first off, we rarely admit people voluntarily. They almost always come in on the three-day ex parte area. And I know of none from my studying of the records who were switched from a voluntary to a 30-day commitment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have a motion to adopt the CS?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move CS for House Bill number 366, version LS1172 Oscar, as a working document.
I'm going to close public testimony, bring it back to the committee. Any discussion on the committee? Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
I'd like to move CS for House Bill 366, version LS1172 Oscar, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal amount.
Any discussion or objection? Without objection, the bill passes.
Mr. Chair.
Stand by. Yes, Reverend Isaacson.
I appreciate the fact that the sponsors brought forward this bill, and one of the things that might be an unintended consequence is that with a state that has a high concentration of military and a very profound respect for the right to bear arms, that we make sure that it is maybe through the judiciary and to the sponsor that we can make sure that the ability to have your documents sealed and to redress maybe a wrongful commitment and what they might feel was, or corrected treatment, the ability to get your rights back, I'd like to see tightened up in this somehow. And maybe through judiciary we can do it. Because when somebody who can't afford an attorney and therefore is excluded from the process of relief, to me that's the only sore spot on this bill. I think, and maybe in judiciary, you can get it tightened up. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hughes.
And thank you for the chance to make a comment. Thank you, sponsor, for bringing the bill forward. If we can know that those that are carrying guns are not in a state where it could be unsafe for our children and our families, I think that's a good thing. However, I continue to have some concern about that little thing in the weeds, the expunge versus the seal, because I do think that they're sometimes, 25 years later in someone's life, they could be fully healthy, and I am concerned that, that something could leak out. So I, and it's concerning to me that there's not a process for expunging. And so tendrils or no tendrils, I still think that if a person should have the right to request that, knowing that that won't some, you know, that record won't someday come back when they're fully healthy. And so I'm, now that I know that it's going to judiciary, I, that might be looked at again. So I feel comfortable.
It might be a potential amendment. We can all talk to Representative Grunberg.
Thank you,
sir. Yeah. Without objection.
The main intent of this bill is good, though. I do think it's good, so thank you. And
I think it's a good bill. I'd like to thank everybody. Without objection, the bill passes from committee. Thank you for bringing this to us. Next up is, get the number here, HB 235, Confidentiality of APOC, Alaska Public Offices Commission Complaints. Please come forward. I believe Representative Higgins.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keller.
Could I move 235-1130 November as the document on the table for presentation?
Okay. Without objection?
Is that the CS?
No, is that the CS or the
That's
original?
The CS, yes.
Okay. Please, let me. At ease. May you please come back to order? Representative Hughes, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and tell us about your bill.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing our bill today and to the committee. I don't know if you've read the my statement or not.
Do you want to summarize it?
And I was going to say, I'll just summarize it, basically. You know, and some of you know me, you know my personality and whatnot, and it's really interesting that there's one thing my mom inbred into my soul, and that is the only thing you have in the end is your name. That's it. That's all you got. The money, the cars, the house, anything you've done really means nothing. It's your name. That's all you have. What this bill does is it protects your name. That's all it does. It protects your name. It doesn't take away any authority from APOC to begin with. It doesn't take away anything from the public disclosures. All we're doing is this, is saying, and this is a summary of what we're doing, is saying this. If someone has a complaint against you to APOC, all we're asking of APOC to do is not make it public until they've done their due diligence, which they're supposed to anyhow, and find out if it has some validity. To the complaint. Once that happens, then it becomes public and everybody can see what's been done. That's all we're asking to do. And that's what this bill is.
Let me ask, so let's say you are a candidate for some public office, and during your campaign, somebody files a complaint against you. This bill would keep it confidential until the complaint is resolved. And then if we found, quote, not guilty of the complaint, it would be kept confidential. If you found guilty of the complaint, I'm just using a term, then it would become public even before the election day. Is that correct?
Correct. Basically, APOC has done their job, and they figured out that, yeah, there is an issue here, and we need to address it. It becomes public. If they find that there is no merit for the complaint, then it just goes away. And that's what this does. And basically what we've done is we've taken away special interest groups and for political reasons.
By political interest group, you're not talking about individual complaints.
Right.
You're talking about a complaint from some political special interest group.
Exactly. That's what this has done. It's taken that away from them.
Now, these are not the – I understand that legislative ethics and APOC are two totally separate entities. And you can be found, for lack of a better term, guilty in one committee, but not the other committee. But it is mirror what we have in legislative ethics, because I believe in that committee, it can be at the wish of the defendant, as it were, that can be kept confidential.
Correct. Yeah, from my understanding.
Okay.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Representative Keller.
Thank you, Representative Higgins. This is a really good bill. I think it is really superb, and I really appreciate bringing it forward. I noticed that, you know, the trigger is described in the bill with a phrase, until the commission determines that a violation has been made, until the commission determines, until, you know, that's the legal phrase. I think it's about four or five times in the bill. And what I'd like to hear from APOC is what criteria they currently use or what they plan to use, you know, to, because now that trigger is very, very significant. I want to know what it is. In other words, is it a subjective process they go through? And it's probably a question for Paul, who's online, but I just wondered what your thoughts were on it.
Yeah, I don't have Tom, do you have to talk to him?
Sir, Tom Stuller, staff for Representative Higgins. That process would be left to APOC on when that determination is made, and I don't want to speak for the department.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, a complaint can be simple or it can be very complex. And that determine how long it might take for APOC to investigate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Stay there. Paul Duvenis, APOC, are you online, sir?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am.
Okay. Please introduce yourself and make whatever comments you'd like to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Dauphiné. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I think first, with the chairs and committee's permission, I'd like to go through the complaint process very briefly, if that's okay, and then answer Representative Keller's question.
Okay. Go ahead,
when
sir.
When a complaint arrives at the Public Offices Commission, we check it for appropriate technical aspects, and there are seven of them. Is the full name and information of the complainant on the complaint? Who is the respondent or who is the charge being levied against? What's the statute or regulation allegedly violated? There needs to be a clear and concise description of the facts that, if true, would be a violation. The complainant's knowledge of these facts, any relevant documentation, and finally, proof that the complaint and the documents have been served on the person who's being accused of this. If the staff accepts the complaint, letters are sent to the complainant and the respondent. The respondent may reply to the complaint within 15 days. An investigation then occurs and a staff report is completed within 30 days of acceptance of the complaint. The staff report is published. The respondent may respond to the staff report within 15 days. The commission has a hearing, and then the order is from the commission is produced within 10 days of the hearing. Under our current process, all of these documents are public. When we staff take this on, and this is thing that I get questioned on a lot, staff makes a recommendation. Staff is not a decision maker in these processes. Staff makes a recommendation to the commission based on the investigation that we've done. So in the language of this bill, nothing would be public until the commission makes a decision. And that's under, in all of these documents would be not public.
And so today, I could make a complaint against somebody, the complaint would be immediately public. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, it would be a public document. We do not do press releases or anything like that.
Well, I've seen press releases in the past, but I suppose that's after you make a decision.
Mr. Chair, from at least my recollection, the only press release I've done was an advertisement for the public member of the commission.
Okay, I'll follow up on that later. Go ahead, sir.
Through the chair, Chairman Lynn.
Yes.
APOC does not make press releases, and I think that's appropriate that they don't. However, the second that they make that public, then comes the frenzy with the media that now has that public document in their hand, and thereby comes all the press that comes with that. It's not APOC. is doing that. But because the document is now a public document, it's out there for view, and then off we go to the races.
And so if somebody makes a complaint, I suppose that's on the agenda someplace? Is that Mr. Dauphiné?
Mr. Chair, yes, when we have a commission meeting, it does go on the agenda. Also, when we receive a complaint and we accept it, because it's a public document, we're required to, have that document available, and the media often checks our website to see what's been posted recently.
So if somebody makes a complaint against candidate X, you put that on the agenda, complaint is filed against candidate X, or just, I mean, that's public at that point, I would think.
Mr. Chair, when you say on the agenda, my mind is going to a commission meeting, and we would list on the agenda the complaint number, 1401-CD. It is just a reference number for us and the parties. That's it.
Okay, but no names on either side.
We would have the parties listed, yes, sir.
Okay, and then also on these complaints, do you list the name at some point of the complainant, or you try to keep that secret?
Mr. Chair, no, that is part of when we list it on the agenda, it's the complainant and or the respondent. So it's 14-01-CD-XVY.
Okay.
Through the chair.
President Christ Tompkins?
But again, Mr. Chair, this is on the commission agenda. When we make the document public, it's the entire document that's public.
I don't suppose you do, but do you have a position on this bill, proposed bill? Do you favor it or oppose it, or are you noncommittal, Mr. Dauphiné? Are you there?
Mr. Chair, yeah. I have you on my computer screen on Ledge TV, and I can see things happening. If you're addressing me, I cannot hear you.
Okay. I'll pass on that. Christ, Tompkins.
Mr. Chair, I think I can hear now.
Okay, thank you. No, I'll just pass on that. Representative Christ Tompkins.
I'm sorry, I was mistaken, sir.
Thank you. This is a question for the sponsor. How does the complaint process currently differ from the complaint process with the Legislative Select Committee on Ethics?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, the current process is that if an individual files a complaint against a candidate, that complaint is made public before the commission ever hears it. It's a public document. There is no confidentiality in it. Based on a statement of the facts, if true, is made public. Under the bill, that would remain confidential until there is a finding by the commission that those facts are in fact true, that the allegation has merit. It's not just an allegation based on what I perceive to be the facts by the person filing it.
And
Representative Higgins?
And through the chair, you know, we thought about that, and we said, well, what's going to keep anybody from basically calling a newspaper and saying, hey, I filed a complaint against any, you know, you. And in our bill, what we've done is we've basically said, if you do that, if you make this public without the commission doing their due diligence, then they will dismiss this complaint.
Is what we do
within our legislative body, so that way we'll keep that from happening. Hopefully, you know, that won't happen very often.
Of course, I think we all know that, you know, some complaints are perfectly valid.
Exactly.
On the other hand, some complaints are political game playing, simply to discredit somebody during a campaign as part of the campaign, rather than an honest complaint against somebody who maybe needs to be complained against.
Right, and through the chair, what we're trying to do here is let APOC do their job. We're not basically telling them not to do their job. We're giving them the tools that they can do their job, which they were set to do, and that's what this bill is all about.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, yes.
So if this bill passes, will the APOC complaint process and the Legislative Select Committee on Ethics complaint process substantively differ in any way?
No, I don't believe so.
Thank you. Any other questions? Reverend Hughes.
I just have a process question because when a case is up then before the APOC commission, and this may need to go back to Paul, that's a public meeting, and we're not using names, so we're just using complainant respondent throughout the meeting, correct? I think, I'm not sure, maybe the sponsor or staff know, in the ethics committee, I think they will have a closed meeting, won't they, so they can use names. So that would perhaps be a difference. And so if you could answer that, please.
I would go ahead and defer to the department on their process and the actual hearing. To my knowledge, it is public. And I'm not sure whether they use names or use respondent and petitioner. That would be an answer for Paul.
Follow up?
Is the director online so he can answer that?
Mr. Dauvernay?
Mr. Chair, yes, the phone connection has been restored. And through the chair to Representative Hughes, in our current process, the meeting is open, as are all the documents, and we do use people's names during the hearing. And in fact, they come and present to the commission either in person or telephonically and occasionally with counsel. Under the way I understand this bill, the meeting would be closed, all documents would be held confidential. And I don't know what Ledge Ethics does.
Now, these are two different things. The Ledge Ethics rules are made by the legislature, I suppose, and the APOC is under regulation, which we're considering here. And you can be found guilty in one but not the other, or vice versa. Reverend Hughes, did that satisfy you on that?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Any other? Do we have a CS on this?
We moved it for presentation, but I'll move it for a discussion if you would.
Okay.
I'll move 235 version 1130 November as a working document, CS.
Any objection? No objection. We're not working on the CS. Is anybody else online who would like to testify? Anybody in the room would like to testify? If not, I'll close the public testimony, bring it to the committee for discussion. Any discussion from the committee? And this goes to judiciary next, I believe?
It does.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you to the sponsor for bringing this forward. It does make a good clarification, and it takes gamesmanship out of a process that's intended to help guide the behavior of us who are in elected office, and yet not make our behavior until proven guilty a version for the media just to toss around. So thank you for doing this, and from what Paul's testimony was, it sounds like it's completely doable by the department, and it'll still govern properly behavior, and yet takes that other element out of it. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from the committee? Representative Keller.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move CS for House Bill 235, version LS 1130, November out of committee with individual recommendations, and I believe it's a zero fiscal note. The attached zero fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, it moves from committee. Thank you for bringing it before us. Our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, March 13th, and this is HB 310 U.S. Constitutional Convention delegates. I believe that's from Representative Tammy Wilson. Any other business come before the committee? I'd like to thank everybody. We are adjourned.